been on wars we fight, driving about the way things ought to be. Well, I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in the fog. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. The guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They live on milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking down with life, I'm fighting in a fog of night. If you don't love it, leave it. But this song I'm singing, be warned. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be warned. When you run it down my country, man, you're walking on right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program. Here on lightresistanceradio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And, of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, here's an interesting commentary by Dr. Christopher Dummett. He's a professor of history at Trent University in Ontario, and this is in today's National Post. That's the Post of July 5th, and it's entitled, Universities Must Welcome Diverse Views. Universities are supposed to be truth-finding hubs, testing ideas, solving problems, and asking new questions that others are either too afraid or too busy to ask. But to achieve their purpose, they must become diverse. They must welcome diverse viewpoints and not stifle dissent. Of course, it's happening all too much. And he goes on to say, unfortunately, there's growing evidence that universities are falling short. Well, that's being kind about it. The problem is political. Universities have always been liberal places, but recent data from the United States shows that the slight bias of the past has hugely increased. Study after study of professors' political affiliations show that the professoriate skews strongly to the left. A 2017 study of American professors found that there were 10.5 Democrats to every single Republican. In some disciplines, especially in the social sciences outside of economics, the imbalance is even stronger. In my own field of history, he writes, that U.S. ratio is 33.5 to 1 in favor of the left. So for every 33 and a half professors who are on the left, only one would identify as being on the right or being a conservative. And the ratio has been growing even greater in recent years. Professors, like everyone else, are subject to confirmation bias. We think alike even when we believe we are impartial. scholarship is supposed to work by externalizing a critical process through peer review, which means that before an article is published in a scholarly paper, it is reviewed by experts in the field to make sure that it's, let's say, basically factual. We contract out our rationality to rival experts to assess our findings. Humans may not be good at detecting the faults in their own reasoning, but we are excellent at finding fault in others, especially with those with whom we disagree. But what happens when scholarly communities don't contain genuinely divergent views? The grievance studies hoax this past year gave us an uncomfortable glimpse of what can go wrong with peer review. This is an amazing incident. Three academic outsiders made up 20 fake papers and submitted them to journals in a series of left-leaning sub-disciplines. The fake articles were written to appeal to the political biases of the field, often in ludicrously exaggerated ways. Now, this is a supposedly academic paper. These were phony papers, but how best to teach students about privilege? These were some of the topics. Try ranking students in a class according to privilege scores and even chaining white male students on the ground so that they can know what it feels like to be oppressed. Two separate papers cut and pasted sections of Hitler's Mein Kampf, but swapped out Hitler's anti-Semitic heroes and enemies for their feminist alternatives. No one noticed. The hoax infuriated many academic insiders, even while others laughed uproariously. But entertainment frustration value aside, the biggest takeaway is what happens when the papers were sent to peer review. Not only did the reviewers miss the hoax, they actually pushed the fake authors to be even more outrageously partisan and one-sided. This is the scary thing, that these hoaxers who set out to do this were able to fool left-wing professors in peer review. That really is something. We should all be concerned by the growth of a university ideological monoculture. Scholars in the humanities and social sciences can help us solve real problems. What counts as progress and are achieving it? How big is the problem of racism in this country, and how should we solve it? What is the best way to foster economic growth for all? How should we understand the gender wage gap, and what should we do about it? Yet how can we trust scholarship to give us useful answers if there isn't a genuine intellectual debate? So this is a good question. And that, of course, is why many people consider much of what's coming out of academia today to be just plain nutty. Well, I don't very often get anything very useful out of a left-wing weekly tabloid called Now. It started off as an entertainment magazine, community events, what's going on in the club scene, etc., with political articles, and over the years it's been very, very left-wing. But here's an interesting one. The charity trap. Jewish National Fund's charitable status is in question over donations to the Israeli military. On May 15th, a petition calling on the Minister of National Revenue to revoke the charitable status of the Jewish National Fund's Canadian branch was presented in the House of Commons by Quebec NDP or Socialist Member of Parliament Pierre-Luc Dussault. Now, I've got to explain something. Charitable status in Canada is a little bit like 501c3 in the United States. Charitable status allows donors to a group with that status to deduct their donations from their income tax. Now, to qualify as a charity, a group has to be nonpartisan. it has to be devoted to some, to good work. So it could be relief of poverty, like, you know, a food bank, let's say, religion. For instance, churches are tax exempt or have charitable status. So if you give a donation to your local church, it's tax exempt. Education in the broad sense, not just classroom education, but putting out information. Now, the it must be non-political in the sense that you don't support the charity does not support a particular cause or party, and advocacy. And for years, I and others have challenged the charitable status of some of the left-wing echo groups and foreign aid groups, supposed foreign aid groups, because of their strong political stands. Anyway, this is not about that. This is about the another group, the Jewish National Fund. Now, the Jewish National Fund is an Israeli thing. Well, why should it have charitable status in Canada? That's a good question, but it gets even worse. The petition has been endorsed by more than 3,500 signatories, including writer physician Dr. Gabor Mat, former UN ambassador for disarmament Peggy Mason, and some retired diplomats and some New Democratic members of Parliament. The Jewish National Fund Canada's charitable status has long been controversial. The organization, quote, committed to reclaiming the Jewish homeland and to making Israel beautiful, strong, and peaceful, has managed to retain the status despite contraventions of international law and Canadian public policy. The Jewish National Fund has been the subject of Canada Revenue Agency audit since 2016 over a complaint that it used charitable donations to help build roads, training, and other infrastructures for the Israeli Defense Force. Canada Revenue Agency guidelines clearly state that supporting the armed forces of another country does not constitute a legitimate charitable activity. JNF says it's no longer involved in the project. But the group continues to restrict the leasing of land it owns in Israel and occupied territories exclusively to Jews, a practice that has been deemed discriminatory by the U.S. State Department, the UN Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, and Israel's own Attorney General. That would seem to disqualify the Jewish National Fund from charitable status in Canada, since Canada Revenue Agency guidelines also state that a charity, quote, cannot restrict delivery of benefits to a certain group or class of persons without adequate justification. A majority of its environmental projects are actually situated on demolished Palestinian villages. According to Israeli non-governmental organization Zokrot, which means remembering, 46 of 68 of the Jewish National Fund's forestation projects have been built on the ruins of 89 Palestinian villages destroyed during the 1948 and 1967 wars. Jewish National Fund official Michael Katorsa has been quoted as admitting that, quote, a large portion of Jewish National Fund parks are on lands where Palestinian villages used to stand, and forests are intended to camouflage this. One such exercise in camouflage is Jewish National Fund Canada's flagship project, Ayalon Canada Park, which is planted over three villages, Imwas, Beit Nuba, and Yalo, depopulated of their Palestinian inhabitants during Israel's 1967 offensive on the West Bank. Internal documents from the Canadian government acknowledge that Parks Canada is located, the Canada Park is located on occupied land. To be sure, activities aimed at cementing permanent Israeli control over the occupied territories are a violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention and likely constitute war crimes under the statute of the International Criminal Court. As the Canada Revenue Agency recently noted in its decision to revoke the status of Beth Olof Charitable Organization, another Jewish charity that has raised money to support Israel's military, quote, providing assistance to Israeli settlements in the occupied territory serves to encourage and enhance the permanency of the infrastructure and settlements, and therefore is contrary to Canada's public policy and international law on this issue. Therefore, at the very least, is not charitable. While the Liberal government ended the Harper government's notoriously discriminatory use of charity audits, the case of Jewish National Fund Canada indicates a continuing double standard. Several Muslim charities, for example, have been penalized and stigmatized far more tangentially for far more tangential associations with alleged terrorism. Between 2013 and 2017, Canada Revenue Agency revoked the status of three charities affiliated with the Islamic Society of North America, Canada, for giving money to Canadian organizations that donated to the Kashmiri humanitarian organization with possible connections to the Pakistan-linked political organization whose armed wing had been designated a terrorist organization by India and the European Union. Anyway, I have a problem with giving charitable status to any organization affiliated with a foreign country. Charitable relief in Canada, yeah. Giving charitable status to projects in Israel, no way. Now, that doesn't mean Canadians can't donate. It just means that they would have to donate out of their own pocket without sort of a rebate, a tax tie. The way it works is enter in the amount of charitable donations that you've given up to a certain amount, and you a percentage of that becomes a tax credit. So it's worth something to you in terms of basically a rebate to give to a charity, and perhaps there's some public use to that. However, assisting foreign countries, I simply don't see that at all, let alone the particular conditions that are being looked at here. Now, what do we have here? Oh yeah, good. Well, here's some good news. while still on Israel, actually not good news. Israeli missile strike kills 4 civilians. Israeli warplanes fired missiles targeting Syrian military positions in Homs, which is in Syria, incidentally, and the Damascus outskirts in an attack that killed at least 4 civilians and wounded another 21, according to Syrian state media. The Syrian military said Syrian air defenses had confronted the attack, which was launched from Lebanese airspace. And an Israeli military spokeswoman asked about the report, said, "We don't comment on such reports." Oh, wait a sec. They're bombing a foreign country. Can you imagine, let's say, Canadian bombers, assuming we have any, bombing, let's say, Des Moines, Iowa. Did you get the picture? Well, that'd be an act of war. The U.S. government would rightly be up in arms. Planes would be flying over Canada exacting retribution. And rightly so. An Israeli military... Oh, yeah, she doesn't make any comments. Syrian broadcaster Al-Ikbaria said the 4 civilians included a baby, including a baby being killed in Sana'a, south of Damascus, as a result of the Zionist aggression. State news agency SANA, or S-A-N-A, said an additional 21 people had been wounded. SANA also reported that Syrian air defenses had brought down a number of the missiles. So, Syrian warplanes launch missiles into, I'm sorry, Israeli warplanes launch missiles into Syria. Well, and this news story, which is from Reuters, doesn't even explain what the alleged reasons were. Now, this type of thing happens all the time. And it's one of the reasons that this whole Middle East thing has poisoned international relations and has damaged the reputation of the United States and of other Western countries like Canada that more or less dutifully go along with the wildly pro-Zionist or pro-Jewish policies of the United States. And the United States policies are basically bought and paid for by the Israeli lobby, by the Jewish lobby, or AIPAC, the American Israel Political Action Committee. It is extraordinary that the politicians of a strong country have been so corrupted. It's not unusual for the politicians of a weak country to be corrupted by outside strong powers, you know, who basically bribe them or buy them up. There's nothing new about that. What is new is that the politicians of probably the world's strongest military country, at this point, the world's strongest military power, the world's strongest economic power, the politicians of that country, the United States of America, are bought and paid for, or intimidated and coerced into supporting the political and military interests of a foreign country. It's quite extraordinary. But there are going to be only the very fewest voices in Washington raised against foreign aid for Israel or against the aggressive expansionist policies of the state of Israel. And there would be probably not, if there are any voices, there probably would be not more than a tiny handful, and I literally mean fewer than the fingers on one hand, that would question the legitimacy of the state of Israel. Well, at one point, Zionism was a very controversial issue in the English-speaking world. Many saw it as a very bad thing for this reason. That Zionism has meant the replacement of the Palestinians, Christian and Muslim, from their own country. And their replacement by outsiders, namely Jews. Now, many people, you express it that way, see Zionism as bad. It's not a good thing. And, of course, it has led to over 70 years of conflict. Ongoing conflict, not just between the displaced Palestinians who've been given a little bit of their territory back, on the west, some on the West Bank and the Strip, or the Gaza Strip, but other countries in the Middle East that have been embroiled into this. The plan for a new America was forged by a number of Zionists, including Richard Perle and others who'd had big roles in the Reagan and in the Bush administrations. And it was forged in the late 80s, and it targeted seven major countries in the Middle East to undergo a regime change, basically taking out Israel's major opponents, and all of them but one have fallen. These countries included Libya, Iraq, Iran, Syria. Anyway, seen that way, we understand the endless wars for Israel, the two wars in Iraq, which, yes, in the end, replaced Saddam Hussein. Hooray! Well, really? Saddam was a dictator, no doubt about it. But there are many dictators in the world. what would you say of the government of Saudi Arabia, which is America's ally, in quotation marks, and an ally, really, of Israel? Well, they're not exactly Democrats, are they? Having replaced Saddam Hussein, what do you have in Iraq? Well, varying degrees of chaos. Upwards of 600,000 Iraqis dead, most of them not military. The expenditure of over $2 trillion, that's with a T, that's many billions, $2 trillion of American treasure. First of all, to destroy Iraq, and then to help build it back up. Oh yes, are we not supposed to be concerned about people who are like us, like Christians? Well, the meddling in Iraq, remember, got rid of Saddam Hussein. Guess who was protecting the Christian minority? You got it, Saddam Hussein. And a rather weird, I shouldn't say weird, unusual, pre-Muslim, semi-pagan sect called the Yazidis, a peaceful people in northern Iraq. Well, they're being the subject of attempted genocide by the people, particularly ISIS, that came after our meddling, or American meddling in Iraq. Who protected them? Oh, that's right, Saddam Hussein. The United States, Canada, Britain, the West have labored mightily at the behest of the Zionists to overthrow Bashar al-Assad in Syria. Is Bashar al-Assad a Democrat? No. His family have ruled Syria with an iron fist for almost half a century. But should it be up to us to try to regime change? I don't think it should. This regime change and the civil war backed, interestingly, by the United States, by Israel, by Saudi Arabia, and there are various reasons why other Arab countries would want to meddle in Syria, which go beyond, you know, our little conversation tonight. But the civil war has failed, largely because of the support of Russia and Iran. Bashar al-Assad will remain in power. Is that bad? No, it's good. I'll tell you why. Were he to be overthrown, the regime, the Islamist regime that would replace him, and don't forget, he's not an Islamist, although he's a Muslim. He has not imposed Sharia law and so on in Syria. The regime that would almost certainly replace him would massacre the Alawites. Now, the Alawites, now, not, I didn't say all whites, Alawites. The Alawites, which is the sect that Bashar al-Assad comes from. The Alawites are, you know, would be considered apostates or heretics within Islam. Oh yes, I'm a Christian minority. There's a large Christian minority in Syria. The radical Islamists would massacre them, as they have tried to do the Christians in Iraq. Now, why are we meddling? And meddling always on behalf of people whose values are diametrically opposed to ours. Why? For the state of Israel. And why would we, or the United States of America, with assists from countries like Britain and Canada, do that? Well, particularly in speaking of the United States, the corruption of the political process in the United States by massive Jewish money wielded in a targeted fashion, and Jewish substantial Jewish control of the media. What happens if you buck the Israeli lobby? Well, you're very likely to find yourself exposed. That's it. You mean a long time had the media on your side. You mean a good guy. Now you are an anti-Semite. Oh no! Oh my God! Well, with the befuddled state of public opinion these days, that's pretty much the kiss of death. Your political career has just gone down the toilet with one big flush. Very few survive it. somebody as powerful as a staunch segregationist, Senator J. William Fulbright, a leading figure in the United States Senate in the 50s, 60s, and up to the mid-70s, a man who had led an interesting and principled opposition to the Vietnam War, but was massively popular in the state of Arkansas because he had cleaved to Southern values. He was a segregationist. Suddenly, when he began to buck the Israeli lobby, was the subject of massive bad publicity by the Jewish-controlled media, and to the extent that he was defeated for the first time since Reconstruction by a Republican in Arkansas. That is the power of the Jewish lobby, and politicians know that. Politicians know that they will have to be either incredibly brave or suicidal to buck the Jewish lobby. Now, that is an outrage to an independent country. And part of it is, it will only stop when enough patriots say boldly that we will act in the interests of America first, not a foreign country. And when an aroused people will back them up. Well, when an aroused people will say, we're going to pursue our own interests, not the interests of a foreign country. It will be only at that time that this control and meddling will stop. The thing I like to point out is this. You know, if you could put this in a more neutral frame, think about this. That American political contests or primaries could center around which politician was more supportive of New Guinea. Can you imagine if New Guinea, let's say, New Guinea probably has more people than Israel. Israel's about 8 million people. New Guinea, my guess is about that, too, or maybe more. Okay, supposing New Guinea had a lobby in Washington, and if you were not in favor of aid to New Guinea, and supposing New Guinea had attacked its neighbors, and if you were anything less than supportive of that, you would be denounced as anti-New Guinean, and your opponent in a primary or your opponent in the general election would rise up with great dudgeon and point out that you were anti-New Guinean. And the New Guinea was the most important issue in American foreign policy, and support for the sovereign rights of New Guinea, including their right to invade their neighbors, was fundamental to American policy. And that the litmus test of whether you were a decent human being fit to crawl the earth was your support for New Guinea. And your opponent said, I am 110% pro-New Guinea. Meanwhile, you're only 100% pro-New Guinea. Okay, put in that context, you think, well, this is a comedy skit. And yes, it is. Except, it's not New Guinea, it's Israel. And, you know, when you say New Guinea, you might well say, well, what's to us? Who cares what, in the general sense, who cares what happens in New Guinea? I know, you've got to be, like the best for everybody, yeah. But, I mean, to make New Guinea the focal point of American foreign policy, and to make it a litmus test, the support for New Guinea being the litmus test as to whether you're even a half-decent person, it seems absurd. And well, why isn't New Guinea a vital issue? Well, simply that poor old little New Guinea doesn't have control of much of the American media. What your stand might be on New Guinea, assuming the local media could even place it within 5,000 miles on a map of the world, is of no interest. The local papers would have no particular position probably on New Guinea. And whether you happen to be supportive of the present regime in New Guinea or opposed to it, wouldn't probably particularly matter. It'd be just a one big old horse yawn, a cat yawn. But then New Guinea doesn't have a lot of control of local media. You would not be drummed out of polite society or even society at all if you were denounced as being anti-New Guinean. In fact, a lot of people would have trouble understanding what it even meant to be anti-New Guinean. And then, whether you supported or opposed New Guinea would probably not much matter. There would be no big money backing your opponent if you were, let's say, opposed to the present government of New Guinea. Your opponent would not suddenly be, in the primary or in the general election, would not suddenly be the beneficiary of huge gobs of foreign money coming from New Guinea or New Guinea's erstwhile supporters in the United States. And see, and that's the difference. Now people, in fact, so powerful are the Jewish interests in the United States and Canada that even to discuss this is anti-Semitic. Now I'm not saying anything that isn't true. Every politician, even the semi-brain dead, know the power of the Jewish lobby. They know that to criticize Israel is to risk ruin. Now, is that true? Of course it's true. Of course it's true. Well, if it's true, then how can that be wrong? That's anti-Semitic. I don't know whether it's anti-Semitic or Uncle Semitic or whatever. But my only question is it true? If it's not true, then it's wrong. It's incorrect. But it is true. It is true. And there is a fundamental problem for American independence. Every country, one would hope, should be free to act to the best of its ability in its own interest. I mean, that's the way of the world. But the fact has been that for the better part of at least half a century, the corruption of the American political system has meant that politicians of both parties and have acted against the interests of the United States and in the interests of a foreign power. And this is totally nonpartisan. The liberal wing of the Democratic Party are as pro-Zionist as the conservative wing of the Republican Party. In fact, and you probably know this to be true, staunch conservatives will assail somewhat liberal Democrats for not being sufficiently pro-Israel. And, you know, I read these things and I wince. Oh. This is good news from Sicily, Agrigento, captain of migrant rescue ship in court. Well, that might be described slightly differently. The German captain of a charity rescue ship appeared before a court in Sicily this past Monday after she was arrested for forcing her way into an Italian port carrying illegals that had been rescued off the Libyan coast. Now, wait a second. Rescued off the Libyan coast. This boat had deliberately gone into the waters of a foreign country, Libya, to pick up illegals. And usually this is in cahoots with the people smugglers. They will jam an utterly unsaved number of people into a leaky boat, and then they will contact these roving, supposedly charity ships, which will swoop in and pick up the illegals and then haul them to Europe. This is actually enabling the invasion. The initial hearing in the city of Agrigento was meant to decide whether Carola Rackete, 31, should remain under house arrest or be freed as the investigation continues into her contested rescue mission. Judge Alessandra Vella is going to make a decision next week. Chief Prosecutor Luigi Patronaggio called on the court to lift the house arrest and said a banner from both Agrigento and the nearby island of Lampedusa, which is where they, an island out in the Mediterranean where the illegals are often brought as their first landing. Rachetti, a volunteer for the German charity Sea-Watch, has become a symbol of divisions in Italy over the government's policy of closing ports to non-government rescue ships. Under the brave leadership of the present Italian Vice Premier Salvini, Italy has finally closed the door on an invasion by the Third World, where they were these boats, leaky boats, would come across the Mediterranean, and often the port of first landing would be Italy. And even more egregiously, you get these meddling do-gooder, in quotation marks, charity organizations scouring the coasts of Libya to pick these people up to bring them to Europe. In other words, save them from the risk of taking of crossing the Mediterranean in a leaky boat. This is absolutely just enabling invasion. Now, so good on the Italians for cracking down. This is not the first time they've cracked down, but the Italians are taking their own securities seriously. Now, this, in a sense, brings me back to my previous topic, Libya. Libya was ruled from 1969 until 2011 by a very unusual man named Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. Now, Gaddafi had a bad reputation at one point. Some of the bad reputation, I guess, deserved. He was eccentric. He had some odd economic ideas. Not all really all that odd, though. He really believed in using the oil wealth rather than to buy expensive cars and jets with gold toilets and others, obscene luxuries that some of the Saudi royal family have from time to time bought. He actually believed in spreading that wealth around. There was free university education for Libyan youth. On their marriage, a Libyan couple would be given a kick in the pants. No, a house! You begin to see that his policies, his pro-life policies, might be appealing to his people, which is why he had very considerable support. He had, when I say unusual, I don't mean wrong. Unusual economic ideas about credit, about the banking system. And he wanted to use that for the benefit of the Libyan people. He did, at various times, support some degree of terrorism. But he had changed his ways the last 10 years and was no longer supporting terrorist movements. And he warned the West that all that was standing between us or them and an invasion from Africa was him. He didn't allow hordes of illegals from farther down in the Dark Continent to traipse across Libyan territory, get into boats, and head for Europe. He didn't allow that. Okay. The United States, the U.S. Air Force, Canadian Air Force, the Italian, the French, and the British Air Force intervened in a civil war in Libya in 2011 as part of the so-called Arab Spring. The result was that the balance was tipped in favor of the rebels. Gaddafi's government collapsed. He was murdered in a ditch, pretty ignominiously. And then there was democracy and freedom. No, there wasn't, actually. Libya is horribly divided. A civil war of sorts goes on, and huge quantities of arms have gone to groups that are affiliated with, either with Al-Qaeda or ISIS. Al-Qaeda and ISIS that control a significant portion of present-day Libya, which is essentially in political chaos. Oh, yes, yes. And no longer are hordes of illegals from farther down in the Dark Continent kept out of Libya. Libya is a troubled passageway to Europe. I say troubled because sometimes one faction or another apprehends people in Libya. Sometimes they intern them. Sometimes they abuse them. Very often they let them through. It's corrupt. But the bottom line is that the control that Gaddafi once had, that saved Europe, that prevented that invasion across the Mediterranean, is no longer there. Hooray! We overthrew Gaddafi. Oh, yeah. Is it really a hooray? Well, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. I'm going to take my musical break right now. And this is from the Grand Ole Opry. And I hope I can get it here. we do have our problems, don't we? So here's Kris Kristofferson and others at a tribute to Johnny Cash.
Johnny Cash and Bill Clinton, as it should be. Well, I woke up Sunday morning, no way to hold my head, it didn't hurt.
This is 1996 at the Kennedy Center.
I wash my face, comb my hair, stumble down the stairs to meet the day. Then I cross the empty street, caught the Sunday smell of someone fried chicken. And it took me back to something that I'd lost somehow, somewhere along the way. On the Sunday morning sidewalk, wishing, Lord, that I was stoned. Oh, there's something in Sunday makes a body feel alone. There ain't nothing short of dying half as lonesome as the sound on the sleeping city sidewalk. Sunday morning coming down.
Ladies and gentlemen, Lyle Lovett.
Mr. Cash, thank you for writing so many great songs for us.
Well, I hear the train coming, it's a rolling round again. And I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps a rolling on down to San Antonio. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. And when I hear that whistle blow, I hang my head.
Ladies and gentlemen, Emmy Lou Harris.
I love you, John. And you know love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring. Long, oh, while the time I fell into ring of fire.
Ladies and gentlemen, Roseanne Cash.
My father is a man of many paradoxes. He was raised on a farm, informed by hard manual labor, and he emerged a poet with a powerful, resonant voice. He was brought up a Baptist, and yet he has the soul of a mystic. He's lived a hard life, a tough life, and yet he has a sensitivity to beauty and elegance and children that is beyond compare. The tie that binds all of these things together is Johnny Cash, the songwriter. And as a songwriter, he is profoundly original. This is the song that defines him more than any other, his signature song, and the song that he's sung every concert for the last 40 years. I want to do this for you, Dad. I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the time that binds, because you're mine. I walk the line. I find it very, very easy to be true. I find myself alone when each day is through. Yes, I'll admit that I'm a fool for you, because you're mine. I walk the line. You've got a way to keep me on your side. You give me calls, love that I can't hide. For you, I know I'd even try to turn the tide. Because you're mine, I walk the line. I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. Keep the ends out for the time it binds, because you're mine. I walk the line, because you're mine. I walk the Dad, this is a song you used to sing in the fields with your family, and you can relax now. We're going to sing it to you.
Some glad morning, when this life is on, I fly away to that home on God's celestial shore. I'll fly away. Life is o'er, I'll fly away.
Like a bird from prison walls has flown, I'll fly away.
I'll fly away for glory, I'll fly away.
When I die,
hallelujah, by a cloud,
This was 1996, a tribute to Johnny Cash at the Kennedy Center in Washington. It was performed in front of President Clinton and included such singers as Kris Kristofferson, whom you heard, Lyle Lovett, Emmylou Harris, and Roseanne Cash. And this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern Time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon, all of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, would the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together the thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Our fair dominion now extends from Cape Race to Nootka Sound. May peace forever be our lot and plenteous store abound. And may those ties of love be ours which discord cannot sever, and flourish green o'er freedom's home the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf.